Nights featuring Gerald Alston, November 29th, and Take 6, December 4th. Details at birchmere.com.
Support for WPFW comes in part from Friends of the Congo, a 501c3 entity who will be hosting Love Sound, an evening of soul sisters in support of WPFW and the Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will take place on Sunday, November 2nd, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church at 400 I Street Southwest. Performers include Free Benjamin, Wena, Anna Mualago, Ayana Gregory, and more. More information on this event is available at WPFWFM.org. Support for WPFW comes in part of Soul Sisters in support of WPFW and the Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will take place on Sunday, November 2nd, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church at 400 I Street Southwest. Performers include Free Benjamin, Wena, Anna Mualago, Ayana Gregory, and more. More information on this event is available at WPFWFM.org.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Free Frank McWhorter, Freedom Seekers, and New Philadelphia. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muzum Tali. The music in the background is Africa by Jonathan Butler. And we play that remembering his birthday, which was on October 10. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the listeners for supporting Africa Now and WPFW during our recently concluded fall pledge drive. We know these are difficult times for many, thus we do not take your support for granted. We are truly humbled by your constant generosity, which enables WPFW to help build a better world one broadcast at a time. Today, the show focuses on the freedom-seeking Black radical tradition, the story of a family focused on freedom, and the resistance that took place every day against slavery. Our topic, Free Frank McWhorter, Freedom Seekers, and New Philadelphia, is presented in the context of the current attack on Black history and the university. The show features a conversation between Dr. Abdullah Kalamat and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. Dr. Abdul Al-Kalamat is one of the founders of Black Studies and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Here is the conversation with Dr. Abdul Al-Kalamat.
It was 1839, and Frank and Lucy McWhorter were getting married for the second time. The wedding was a reaffirmation of their love and a recommitment to all they had built together. They had come to Illinois with four of their children and built a farm of golden wheat fields and towering stalks of corn. Though there was plenty of symbolism in their renewed vows, the McWhorters remarried for a more pragmatic reason. They had been enslaved in Kentucky when they first committed to each other, but such marriages were rarely respected by U.S. courts. They had been enslaved when they started their family, but Frank quickly began to plot their way to freedom. Frank's owner and father, George McWhorter, trusted Frank to manage his farm and gave him leeway to earn money for doing extra work. So Frank learned how to mine and manufacture his own saltpeter, a necessary component in gunpowder. He used the money he earned selling saltpeter to buy freedom for him and his family. He began freeing his family in 1817. By this time, Lucy and Frank were raising Judah, Frank Jr., Sarah, and Solomon. but Frank first bought Lucy's freedom. She was pregnant at the time, so not only did he free Lucy, but his purchase also ensured that their son, Squire, would be born free. In 1819, he bought his own freedom, becoming Free Frank, and later changed his name to Frank McWhorter, dropping the H from his former enslaver's last name. Frank and Lucy, along with several children they had managed to free, moved west to Illinois in 1830 to the land that would become their farm in Pike County. He traded his saltpeter operation for Frank Jr.'s freedom after Jr. had fled his enslavement to Canada. Frank made trips back to Kentucky to purchase the freedom of each of his three remaining enslaved children and at least one grandchild. On each trip, Frank McWhorter had to make the gut-wrenching decision of which child he would free and which he would have to leave behind to endure slavery. The McWhorters spent $14,000 to free their family. Adjusted for inflation, that's nearly $500,000 today. Frank McWhorter began his farm with 160 acres and eventually increased these holdings to over 500 acres. Along with his corn and wheat, he grew oats and raised cattle, hogs, and horses. In 1836, Frank divided 42 acres of his land into town lots and founded the town of New Philadelphia. The town, the first officially founded by African Americans, prospered with both black and white residents and formed part of a larger rural community of farmers. The town's very existence as a biracial community in a state with repressive black codes on the books until 1865 was a defiant statement against racial inequality. New Philadelphia was an audacious project, a prelude to black communities like Nicodemus, Kansas, DeWitty, Nebraska, Blackdom, New Mexico, Boley, Oklahoma, founded in the West after the Civil War. Joining us for a discussion on Free Frank, New Philadelphia, and Freedom Seekers is Professor Abdullah Kalimat. Abdullah Kalimat is a founder of the field of Black Studies and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A lifelong scholar-organizer with a PhD from the University of Chicago, he has lectured, taught, and directed academic programs across the United States, the Caribbean, Africa, Europe, and China. His academic organizing trajectory stems as former chair of the Chicago chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s, to a prominent organizer in the African Liberation Support Movement, to being a co-founder of the Black Radical Congress in 1998. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. Greetings. Thank you, Brother Abdul, for taking the time to join us to have a robust discussion, not only about the history of your own family in abolition, but also freedom seeking, Black radical tradition, the whole run, the whole gambit. But also, how does the attacks on Black history, the attacks on the university education fit into this narrative of New Philadelphia, Free Frankwater? And also, what is the role of Black studies in the overall question? So as we begin, it's a pleasure to always have a conversation and think with you out in space, but let's go ahead and dig right in. Let's talk about New Philadelphia. Let's talk about Free Frank McWhorter in the context of history. What was New Philadelphia? Who was Free Frank? And then we'll move from there.
Thank you for this opportunity. This story really is a story that I grew up with as a family story. It was our story. And then it wasn't until later that I began to understand in a bigger sense, it's our story. It's really a story about the African-American experience. And what's interesting is that Frank, known as Free Frank, because he was able to purchase himself out of slavery, was born in 1777. And we all know that's an interesting date, because 1776 is the birth of the country. And so he was born in South Carolina at that time, his mother from West Africa. He was able, as an enslaved person, he was taken from South Carolina to Kentucky. And in Kentucky, he was able to eventually hire himself out and began to acquire some savings. He also was able to develop his own initiative in entrepreneurship. He actually began to mine saltpeter, which is an ingredient in gunpowder. And because of the War of 1812, at that time, the cost of gunpowder, I mean, the cost of saltpeter per pound went from 17 cents to $1. It was that kind of increase because of the demand for gunpowder. So he was able to save enough money to buy his wife out of slavery for $800, which is about $15,000 in current money. Then a couple of years later, was able to buy himself out of slavery, eventually bought 16 family members. His first son, Frank Rantou, became a freedom seeker, and he ran to Canada. And then Frank eventually was able to have enough money to pay for his freedom as well. He returns to Kentucky, and then they go to Illinois. So what we have here is a story of freedom, and it's a story of a family focused on freedom. And what happened is he was able to sell everything he had in Kentucky for a plot of land in Illinois, which was part of the land that was granted to veterans of the War of 1812. And there was there's a big market around the country. Many of these people didn't even go to the land that they had received from the government. He was able to buy this land, and his family then moved to Illinois. And it's interesting because then in Illinois, he was able to found a town, the first African-American to legally plat and register a town. It was registered because it was illegal for an African-American to incorporate a town, but he nevertheless was able to register it. Now, this is he gets to Illinois in 1830. He plots and registers a town in 1836. And then in 1837, he gets the Illinois State Legislature to pass a law legalizing his last name. So he had been known as Free Frank. In fact, even in the census, he's listed as Free Frank after he purchased himself. And so he then went from Free Frank to Frank McWhorter. His former slave owners were McWhorters, but they had an H in their name. And so when he got the law passed, he took the H out because he did not want them to be able to come and claim that they own whatever it is that he owned. And what's interesting is that when that law was passed, Abe Lincoln was in the legislature. So there's a Lincoln connection. Then in the town became a station on the Underground Railroad. And so this is a story of freedom. We often use the poem I wrote called Seven Ways to Freedom. They ran, they helped others run. They bought, they fought, a town, a law, and they lived free. And each one of those things they experienced. And so now that's part of what we call the grand narrative of African-American history. This is really a pushback against postmodernism, the whole idea that there is no connecting narrative to the overall historical experience. And we think that freedom, the struggle, first of all, to survive the barbarism of slavery, but that survival was always pushed by a freedom narrative. So the Underground Railroad, but even more than that, it's sort of like that old Ethiopian proverb, when the emperor walks by, the peasant bows and silently farts. You know, there's a resistance that took place in a daily way against the barbarism of slavery. So the story of New Philadelphia, the story of Frank and Lucy McWhorter, It's a story of freedom.
So let's pull on that particular notion, because even the notion of the Underground Railroad, the acts of resistance, particularly, weapons of the weak, right? You know, this notion, the idea of the Ethiopian proverb that you present, the story of the strategies and also the acts, whether they're little are big, but the little acts become subverted in this grand narrative, right? This postmodern that you pay attention to. Could you talk a little bit more about the connection of New Philadelphia, this land, and also the region itself, those who are seeking freedom? How did that look in the context? Because again, we're talking about Africans who were enslaved, escaping from the South. But of course, we know that they were escaping to the West as well. What does this look? How does New Philadelphia, Free Frank McWhorter, fit into this strategy of freedom that we can look at today?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, there's struggle over language. We call people freedom seekers who were escaping slavery, as opposed to contraband or in any way taking the slave owner's perspective, that they were property that was being taken from them. There's a struggle in the literature over that. But then secondly, the interesting thing about the timing of Frank and Lucy's experience, think about it. They get to Illinois in 1830, and then 1836, 1837. Well, what else is happening during this time? Well, first of all, there's the Nat Turner Rebellion, 1831. That's Virginia. That became a national crisis for not only slave owners, but what happened is that the abolitionist activity in the South diminished. The abolitionist activity in the North expanded. So 1830s was a very critical moment, and the Nat Turner Rebellion is part of that. But also in 1830, the National Negro Convention movement begins. And so that there are these meetings that take place, they discuss, there are only three options, really. One is maybe we can negotiate a better situation. So people were writing petitions, lighten up a little bit, that kind of thing. But the second is maybe we could get the hell out of here, find some place to go. And the third is we might have to fight these people. So you had that constant discussion during the National Negro Convention movement. And Frank and Lucy were able to use the entrepreneurial road of saving money to purchase 16 family members out of slavery. But what's interesting is that there were then three trips that had to be made from Illinois back to Kentucky. Now, these are not people, they're not literate, but they had to be able to deal with money. And so Frank goes back and buys a son, Solomon. He's 19 years old. And we have an oral history of him returning, explaining to Solomon what it means to be free and what his responsibilities are to the family and to the community. Because suddenly here he's 19 years old, he grows up, the white people are slave owners. Now he's suddenly equal community members with people who are abolitionists living in this village, New Philadelphia. But also then one of his daughters, Sarah, has to go back to Kentucky and buy three of her children, Frank and Lucy's grandchildren, from slavery from three different owners. And one of the ways that this happened was a son of one of the slave owners wrote a letter to Frank. And we have this letter where he says, "Come quick. My father's about to sell, these people. And so you better come quick." So there are these dynamics that are happening. But as you said, the other issue, of course, is this idea that the Underground Railroad is talked about in relationship to the allies of the freedom seekers, the people who were so-called station masters kind of thing. And that is a distorted picture of what actually happened, because as you could well imagine, people trying to get free were going every which way. There was no plan. There was no map. So there, you know, this idea of a railroad, you know, you think of tracks, you think of a set trail. No, no, people were going every which way. And we know this because my wife developed a map of the state of Illinois based on the literature that has been written about the Underground Railroad. And we found 429 locations that had been identified as part of the Underground Railroad in Illinois. Now, that reputation really is something that the state of Ohio has, the Underground Railroad state. But finding all these places in Illinois, that means Indiana, you know, any free state is likely to be the site of multiple hundreds of people trying to escape. So in Illinois, you find people not only coming up from the South, you find a lot of people coming in from Missouri. And so what's important about New Philadelphia is that it is 20 miles from the Mississippi River. And of course, that's Missouri. So there's another famous family, the Walker family, that purchased themselves out of slavery in Missouri. They moved to New Philadelphia area, and the Walker women married the McWhorter men. So my grandmother, Ophelia Walker, is an example of that, married Arthur, Solomon's son. So now, see, the thing about Black studies is this whole question of what does it mean to study the African-American experience? And one of the interesting things about the American higher educational experience is that it includes not only theory, but practice. So this idea, for example, of the land-grant institutions that were established to transform the country, both in industrial activity and agricultural activity. I mean, that's the case here at the University of Illinois. So Black studies really fits into that model of American higher education, where the issue is not only how do we study and understand the African-American experience, but how do we do it in such a way that advocates freedom, that advocates a quality of life. It's not just divorced from the world. I mean, that would be like having a college of agriculture that is just interested in studying, you know, what they write in books and what they write on the blackboard. No, college of agriculture trying to improve agricultural production, you know, plants and animals, which is an attempt to increase the quality of life in the country. So Black studies has that responsibility. In fact, it was born as a battlefront for Black power in higher education. And that's a mission that we have to constantly remind ourselves of in order to stay on track.
So let's stay there for a minute and look at New Philadelphia, Free Frank, the practice of moving towards a freedom itself, going back physically, freeing 16 members. And I think for, you know, listeners and folk who are at Gage just have to understand that these are generations. 16 members creates multiple extensions of the family as well. So we can probably, you know, say that released what, 200-300 people, right? You know, moving forward. But let's look at it in the context of Black studies, of the mission of Black studies itself, the study of the Black experience for a particular purpose. How does this story fit in as a model, the land, the context of the time, disrupting, you know, the plantation economy, the political economy, how can we look at this and take maybe two or three lessons historically, but also look at it in the context of this moment right now? Attacks and stuff. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think it's an important question. I think first, Frank's entrepreneurship, which today we would call social entrepreneurship. In other words, going into business, the purpose of a business is to make a profit. for a purpose. So the question is, are you making a profit in order to have a bigger bank account and increase your own personal consumption? Or is it to impact the world in a certain way? And so this would be social entrepreneurship. So that's an example, even as an enslaved person. So that's the first point I would make. And that is, everybody that's interested in going into business or who has that skill should really learn from this social entrepreneurship of the past. A second lesson I think is important is that the first person that Frank purchased was his wife, who was pregnant. And according to the law, if the woman was free, then the child being born would be free. So the brothers ought to take note and respect the obligation, really, to defend family and partners. So that's another lesson from Frank. I think a third lesson is that we use this expression, if New Philadelphia was possible, then maybe America is possible. And by that, this is a town that was created by African Americans. Plots were laid out and sold to people. The majority of people who lived in New Philadelphia were not African Americans. But it was a town dedicated to freedom. So not only was the lot sold in order to get money to buy people out of slavery, it was 20 miles from slavery. So these are places where Black people owned land and had guns. And we know they had guns because there's a family, a white family that lived next door to Frank, and we have their letters. And she talks about how those McWhorter boys are getting to be good shots, you know, and then she's talking about game. And so, well, you know, okay. I mean, so you get the point. So New Philadelphia is also in a general area that had all kind of conflict. See, what a lot of people have to realize about the Civil War is that while it was fought on the battlefields that we know of in the Civil War, and mainly in the South and in the border regions, but it was fought everywhere. Every community had this distinction between, are you for or against the Union? And so that was true in Pike County, Illinois. But there was no, out of all the media and all the history, we have found no contradiction among the people who lived in New Philadelphia. Even though in the southern part of Pike County, it has a reputation of being white Pike with a lot of sundown towns. So here you had, and these were people who were going, there was still some segregation. There was a white cemetery and a Black cemetery, but the children went to the same school, one room schoolhouse. That was contributed by the McWhorter family, the land and the building. So the town itself is a possibility. So we use the Langston Hughes poem, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where everyone is free. We don't use the Make America Great Again in the current, but we use Langston Hughes.
I'm glad you said that, because I wanted to circle back to that notion, because I think people will misread, you know, or mishear what you're saying, because you mentioned this notion of America's possible. We'll set that to the side for a minute, but I want to dig down critically and, you know, deeply here. But you mentioned, you know, social entrepreneurship. We do not want, you know, folk to mix up, you know, this notion with Black capitalism. And I think that this is the distinction between the notion of private property and impersonal property, right? There's a distinction between that, where Free Frank is utilizing its skills to accumulate capital for a particular reason, not for the aggregation in the hands of the few and the propagation, you know, this notion. Did you want to say a little bit more about that to make that distinction? Because I want to make sure that we're clear, because, you know, some people can hear this, but we want to be critical and understanding what we're saying here.
See, the it's an interesting question about how different classes operate in the context of the overall struggle. And at a certain point in time, the Black middle class, as a business element and as a professional element, were serving the Black community. So that under conditions of segregation, for example, and really for that matter, under current conditions of a food desert, the impulse to open a grocery store and to serve people some food is a positive thing. I mean, who could be against opening a grocery store in a food desert so people could come and get some groceries? On the other hand, the level of, for example, franchising McDonald's or Kentucky Fried or whatever is becoming an arm of corporate monopoly capitalism. And so there's a distinction there. In global terms, people often refer to the concept of a national bourgeoisie and a comprador bourgeoisie. So even in terms of the independence struggles in Africa, the national bourgeoisie played a progressive role. You know, so you have to look at things in context. And so Frank becoming an entrepreneur and selling the saltpeter was on a mission to freedom. Partly because even the free Negroes were so limited under those conditions, you know, he didn't even have that choice, you know what I mean, to go all Sadiddy and Mr. Big, you know. So, but today, for example, people who go for the big dollars are often so wedded to the structures and culture of big capitalism that they basically cross over to the other side and do not really serve the freedom impulse, even though, because of the tax structure, et cetera, they might contribute some money, you know, but that's not the main purpose by which they're becoming multimillionaires. I mean, in other words, Oprah does some good things, but she's part of the system. Her base is part of the very structure that we are fighting against and that exploits us. That's how she talks to her accountant and her lawyer, you know, and whatever stock she owns, that's part of that. So I want people to be clear that under slavery, it was one thing to be an entrepreneur dedicated to freedom. Under the conditions of segregation, the Booker T. Washington approach had those two aspects to it. And so you have to look at Booker and you have to look at Du Bois together. But even then, in the segregated communities of New York or any of the cities, the business people were serving the Black community. Without them, there would have been much more suffering and much more sacrifice.
You're listening to a recent conversation that focuses on the freedom-seeking Black radical tradition, the story of a family focused on freedom and the resistance that took place every day against slavery. Our topic, Free Frank McWhorter, Freedom Seekers and New Philadelphia, is presented in the context of the current attack on Black history and the university. The show features a conversation between Dr. Abdullah Kalamat and African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. Dr. Abdullah Kalamat is one of the founders of Black Studies and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The music in the background is You've Gotta Have Freedom by Pharoah Sanders. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
The conditions are very important. The historical conditions, again, as we look at, you know, historical materialism, you know, we have to be clear about the period within which we're operating and be able to kind of, put, you know, not in a pragmatic, unprincipled sense, but what is the objective for the collective? What is the objective of your individual actions that reach to a collective process of freedom. I wanted to, when I was hearing you talk about, you know, the notion of, you know, New Philadelphia and contextualizing it with the violences of slavery, chattel slavery, the constant, you know, opportunities to be raided and extracted. What is maroonage, or how would you fit this notion of maroonage? Because I think people get a very a fantastical version or limited understanding what maroonage is, because, you know, there's conversations in Black studies today about, you know, stealing away to the university and, you know, those type of things, which I think are important. But New Philadelphia and the actions of the McWhorters fit into a process of maroonage? Can it fit? I know it's not a neat type of thing, but I think there's some lessons here.
Yeah, see, I think the whole concept of maroonage really is about illegal settlements that were populated by escaped people from slavery. And automatically, they became military outposts because there was constant armed struggle around most of the Maroons. On the other hand, in the United States, Black towns were established within a certain legal framework. So all those Black towns in Oklahoma or Nicodemus, Kansas, or Mount Bayou, Mississippi, et cetera, were not illegal in the sense of the maroonage of, say, Latin America. We did have in the Gullah and Geechee areas, we had some, and in the Seminole, Florida, there was some maroonage in a classic sense. But one of the interesting things about the American experience is that there is a democracy that has always been a hypocritical, rhetorical representation of a situation that was very oppressive, but there were always elements of freedom within it. In other words, there were Black people who were free. There were Black people who were able to do things. So the Black towns represented a refuge. And what's really interesting about the maroonage or the Black towns is they became very conservative because they were trying to protect themselves. And so it was like, if you lived there and you were one of them, everything was cool. But if you were a freedom seeker and came in and you were a potential threat, you know. So, so Black towns and New Philadelphia is even different than that, because New Philadelphia was, first of all, an integrated town. And secondly, it was focused on freedom. So if you were white and you moved there, even if you didn't know initially, you soon knew, A, this town was run by Black people. You had to buy land from them anyway. And two, it was a freedom village because there were all these, you know, freedom seekers coming through. And we even have white families with oral histories about that. There's this one family, the Eckelbergers, who had a wagon with a false bottom, and they used to be part of the Underground Railroad. So if you got some people who got to New Philadelphia, and we grew up with the idea, if you got to New Philadelphia, you get a pair of shoes and a horse, or then those McWhorter boys would help get you north. The archaeological dig found evidence of two cobblers in town. This tiny little town had two shoemakers, which tends to validate the story that I grew up with, you know. But the Eckelbergers were a white family that had this wagon, and they would take people. There's another family that has a story about, because sometimes the freedom seekers would come, and they would stay in New Philadelphia for a minute and work for the farmers, make some money, and then get on. Well, when the slave catchers, remember the Fugitive Slave Act, when the slave catchers would come and they would see them, they would set a chicken loose and put a dog on the chicken, and a big uproar would happen, and everybody would know that's the time to cut out. And so all the freedom seekers would then, you know, hide. And we had another family, Harry Wright, who was on the county commission. His family oral history talked about a cave on the creek where the freedom seekers would go and hide. So it was a living thing as a part of this town. I mean, it wasn't, and so when I say America might be possible, it's like we have to get rid of this idea that white people are inherently, almost like their DNA is evil. Evil is a social product. Malcolm found this out when he went to Mecca. You know, the soldiers found it out when they had to jump in a foxhole and fight the fascists. I mean, in other words, Black studies programs had to find it out when they had to fight for their survival and get some help, you know. So let's get rid of that idea that, but on the other hand, social production of racism is a default position. It's the normal in America. Even people who don't even feel bad about you, you know, end up absorbing the racism. That's true for Black people as well. That's how we're controlled. We hate them. They hate us. Okay. There can be no unity. And we're all sick and we're all, you know, under Kennedy and the health thing, we're all getting. So anyway, the point is, you know, that that this experience is really very challenging because what it's before the Civil War. You know, now the other thing is that it extends. So Frank's grandson, Squire, his father was the one that Lucy gave birth to after she got free. His name was Squire, too. So Squire the Second joins the Union Army just at the end of the Civil War. But he's in the unit that is assigned to go to Galveston, Texas. So he's part of helping to free the Negroes in Texas. So he's part of Juneteenth. That's how deep it is. You know, and you get all this connection, you know. And that's why, for example, there are two points. One is we want to make sure people know this story. But secondly, we want people to know that, you know, like some people have said to me, do you know that you're part of royalty? You know, this family, the descendant. And I said, look here, man. I said, these were ordinary people doing extraordinary things. So The issue here is that what people can learn from this story is that every family and every community has a history to discover. And it's all going to be connected to this idea that we resisted being enslaved, we resisted being exploited and oppressed. And, you know, even people who we are taught were silly, or were drunk, or were a drug addict, or whatever, there's a story there, you know, because you got to figure out why these things happened and what they really thought, you know, because people, and this is really a deep thing about racism. Racism asserts that Black people are mentally not up to par. We're less, we have deficits. And the truth of the matter is that Black people are intelligent. You know what I mean? And know what's going on, you know, and are trying to figure out how to deal. And when there's a shot, when it's possible, and the great wake up happens, you know, then, you know, there's trouble in the land. That was the Black Lives Matter moment. That was the Black Power moment. You know, that was the fight back of the returning soldiers after World War II. So we have to really, you know, this is the role of Black studies. And I think that part of it is even overcoming this contradiction between what we used to call the cultural nationalists and the revolutionary nationalists. In other words, the affirmation of Black culture and identity, which is fundamental, really, to escaping the racist paradigm that you ain't nothing and you don't come from nowhere, ain't no Negro land, so you know, you're just out here. On the other hand, in terms of the revolutionary nationalists, is to understand that it is possible to think about reconstructing the country. It's possible to think not only about the reforms we can make, but the fundamental changes we can make. So both those things are important. You can't deny the need for identity, deny the need for culture, but you also can't deny the need to fight and to structure the possibility of making life better.
I think that's a very important point, particularly because this is where, you know, Malcolm often talk about, you know, we mix up the means with the objective, meaning we fight over the means of moving and reconstructing, as opposed to making sure that the means are aligned with the collective objective. So what does that look like, I think, is a very important conversation. And this conversation, as you mentioned, the convention movement, as you mentioned, I can imagine the conversations that was happening in New Philadelphia. We can map and you know, all of this, but this also goes into how does this feed the fight back in this current moment of the assault by, you know, a regime, a fascist leaning regime, or a fascist regime that is intending to take all of these narratives, dismiss them through very, very overt means, right? Because the question of reconstruct, it was very interesting because a student asked me yesterday, was saying, I'm taking all of these classes, and he mentioned the notion utopia. He was like, but you guys talk about, you know, these things, but, you know, kind of like this notion of after struggle. And so I think that that question of the possibilities of reconstructing are either constructing alternative forms of social organization. It's a lesson here, right? There's a fight back that is being developed through the historical processes of resistance from then to now. But then what is the conduit? Black studies is that conduit to amplify those conversations in order to actually have a robust, substantive conversation. You took part in some of those things, right? And the African Liberation Support Movement, Which Way Towards Freedom. A lot of your friends and comrades and folk that they're part of that particular history. And, you know, we talk about this as well. Where is that platform today? How do we utilize conferences? How do we utilize symposium, colloquium, whatever, to not just kind of talk about stuff that we like, but we'll talk about substantive issues that can reconstruct. So this fight back, there's a story here that moves into the fight back, but then there's also what's happening to repress, not, you know, obviously the questions of repressing Black history falls directly onto the, you know, to what's happening with New Philadelphia. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, where this preservation story is in the context of New Philadelphia, in relation to the national conversations of repressing, you know, history?
Well, in 2022, New Philadelphia became a national park. It started by Obama signing an order to study it. It eventually then was passed as a part of the omnibus bill under Biden, 2022. So now suddenly it's with the National Park Service. And also, New Philadelphia is in two Smithsonian institutions, the American history and the African American history. Both have exhibits on New Philadelphia. So the current struggle of the current administration is directly impacting the New Philadelphia story being remembered. So the attack on the Smithsonian and the attack on the National Park Service. And you know, if they're cutting back on the budget for Yosemite and those big parks, you know what's happening in a small situation that is specifically about anti-slavery and, you know, and so on. Specifically, when you get a national park, the first thing that has to develop is what they call a foundation document. That's where the purpose of the park and what is expected to be the Park Service's program regarding that park. So we had several committees established working with national park people, et cetera. So we drafted this whole foundation document. This is very recent. It was then submitted to the National Park Service, and they have come back with what they call flagged language that cannot be used. So we're right now in the middle of them trying to revise and change this foundation document. So it's really what the Cubans call the battle of ideas, that there is a struggle over interpretation. There's a struggle over history. There's a struggle over what is the American experience. So one of the things that we've done is we've identified commemorative stamps of the U.S. Postal Service as one of the ways in which the American identity is shared with the people of this country and the people of the world, really. When you get an envelope and it has a stamp on it, that represents this country. Just like money, you know, there are pictures of presidents on the money, and a big struggle over putting a black woman's picture on the money. So that's part of how the struggle over identity goes on. The naming of buildings, the naming of streets, the naming of the identity of on money, the identity of national stamps. So we've got a project to get a stamp for New Philadelphia and Frank and Lucy McWhorter. And this stamp project is really a way of affirming the meaning of freedom in this particular case. And just like, for example, under a different administration, they got a stamp from Malcolm. That was an interesting approval of Malcolm. And of course, we have to continue our struggle so that he doesn't become this strange person, Malcolm the 10th. You know, he becomes Malcolm X.
You've just been listening to a portion of the conversation between Dr. Abdullah Kalamat and African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope. In the conversation, the focus was on the freedom-seeking black radical tradition, the story of a family focused on freedom, and the resistance that took place every day against slavery. Our topic today, Free Frank McWhorter, Freedom Seekers and New Philadelphia, was presented in the context of the current attack on black history and the university. Dr. Abdullah Kalamat is one of the founders of Black Studies and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The full conversation will be available on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Rhythmic Aying by Thelonious Monk, remembering Thelonious Monk's birthday, which was on October 10. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muizzam Tali. Up next is Headline News, which is followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at Northern Africa and issues in the Middle East, and particularly focused on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, which is followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Yaimfi. And that's followed by Kambit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdeston. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. I continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, and a special thank you for supporting us during our recently concluded fall pledge drive. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Choo Choo Steps by Choo Choo Valdez and Kenny Garrett, remembering Choo Choo Valdez's birthday, which was on October 9th, and Kenny Garrett's birthday, which was also on October 9th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And and stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is October 29th. Here are some headlines. Damage assessment, which could take months, began today in Jamaica after Hurricane Melissa struck the island nation with wind speeds of 185 miles per hour. More than 51,000 people were without electricity as of this morning. Bridges were flooded and several roads impassable, making it harder to reach the most hard-hit areas. Prime Minister Andrew Holness declared the country a disaster area, with St. Elizabeth Parish reported to be underwater. Only one fatality has been reported so far, although that number is likely to change as rescue crews make their way through the devastation. Melissa is now a Category 2 storm as it heads toward the Bahamas after making landfall in Cuba overnight and causing severe flooding. In more news, the Department of Defense announced that further boat strikes against alleged drug cartels occurred on Monday, targeting four boats. That's the most targeted in one day. 14 people died in Monday's strikes, also the most since the Trump administration launched its violent campaign to suppress drug smuggling. There was one sole survivor from Monday's strikes, but whether he was left behind on the open ocean is unclear. The Mexican Navy says it picked up a survivor in international waters on Tuesday. These strikes have drawn the anger of several regional powers. The presidents of Mexico and Colombia denounced the aggressive use of force in international waters, while the administration defends itself by claiming lives are saved for every boat destroyed. The administration's actions have also annoyed several Republican senators. Conservative Rand Paul called the strikes extrajudicial killings, and like the Mexican president, he complained that the administration had not even pretended to keep him in the loop. The DEA reports that the majority of cocaine entering the U.S. first travels across the Pacific Ocean, not the Caribbean Sea. And in more news, Israeli airstrikes killed 104 people in Gaza overnight, including 46 children, according to local health officials. The strikes mainly hit residential buildings, shelter tents, and schools. Both Israel and Gaza accuse each other of violating the ceasefire that has been in place for less than 3 weeks. Israel accuses Hamas of firing on its forces in